Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
Changing climate is also likely to change our food sources, and scientists are trying to stay ahead of the curve. Today on the program, we're going to talk about a couple of ways of doing that. Aquaculture, which involves the farming of fish and seaweed in open water, and aquaponics, which is the use of fish waste to grow vegetables in greenhouses. But are these economically viable? Are they sustainable from a resource use perspective? Our guests are here to explore these and other questions and take your calls. Here with me today are Michael Chambers, research scientist with the UNH Cooperative Extension and New Hampshire Sea Grant, and Todd Gerdot, UNH Assistant Professor of Agricultural Engineering. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here, Peter.
Listeners, the number for you to call to ask your questions is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Before we get into your definitions of what these two things are, aquaculture, aquaponics, could we both take a moment to describe the problem or the series of problems that sort of make these necessary? And we'll start with you, Michael. What's the problem that aquaculture is trying to solve?
Well, right now, most of our seafood is shipped in from overseas. About 90% of the seafood we actually eat comes from out of this country. 50% of that seafood is actually raised on farms. We have an annual seafood deficit of about $14 billion a year. So we really see an opportunity here to grow seafood in the United States. Some of the opportunities of growing it here is that we have very high water quality. We have regulations that maintain seafood at higher standards than some of it is when it comes in from overseas. So there's a lot of things that are great about growing seafood here. We do have challenges when we look at going offshore because of the permitting process has not been formalized in federal waters. But in the future, as we grow and if we want to maintain healthy seafood on our plates, we have to grow it here in the United States.
And Todd, what about the need for aquaponics? What is the problem that aquaponics is trying to solve?
Well, one of the issues that we have really is as we're looking to find places to grow fish and address the problems with locales and availability in particular regions is finding places that will allow us to do that. We are no different from any other animal agriculture in the sense that we produce a waste stream. So the problem is that we produce a very watery waste, and so we need to come up with a way to deal with that. And in essence, aquaculture is traditionally land-based aquaculture has traditionally developed methods to treat the water and then essentially dump it. So they spend a lot of money to feed the fish, a lot of money to treat the water, and then a lot of money to permit and discharge. And that represents an internalized cost to the production process. And you see that price come back as a higher bottom line, or higher break-even price, rather. So in essence, we need to come up with a way to do what the rest of animal agriculture does, utilize those wasted nutrients as a wasted opportunity. So we effectively are looking at ways to, for all intents and purposes, aquatically compost our nutrients and turn that around and utilize it as a clean, clear, treated fertilizer product. So we create our own fields. We call that hydroponics.
Mm-hmm. So making better use of the waste that occurs naturally from fish and any other kind of agriculture, but especially fish when it comes to hydroponics.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And for aquaculture, it's a matter of increasing fish stocks locally. So we'll spend the next part of this part of the program talking about aquaculture specifically. Michael, this is your area of expertise. You've worked on this for 25 years. Tell us in simple terms what the field of aquaculture includes? Because fish farming in the open seas is a part of it, but it's not the whole picture.
Right. That's just one aspect. I mean, if we've got catfish farming down south, we've got shrimp farming in Texas. Overseas, you've got shellfish, oysters, seaweeds, particularly in Asia. In Norway and Canada and Chile, you've got salmon farming. So there's big operations everywhere, but it's both land-based and sea-based. The United States has an incredible coastline, particularly our exclusive economic zone, which reaches from state waters out to about 200 miles. And those waters could potentially be farmed in certain areas close to markets that could generate a lot of a very high-value seafood.
And when you say farmed, do you mean, assuming all the permits are in order, which is a separate question, companies or nonprofits could build enormous cages or structures that would allow certain types of fish to grow up safely and healthily?
Absolutely. Excuse me. But if you look at the current cage farming going on right now, it's all in protected water areas, in fjords in Norway or protected areas in other countries. As we move offshore, we're totally exposed. And so you might have seas of 30 to 40 feet tall and strong currents. So the technology is going to be very different offshore. For most cases, you have to go subsurface for the cages and the fish to survive and do well.
Subsurface, what do you mean?
The cage would be perhaps at the surface for feeding, but after you're done feeding, the cage would be submerged down to maybe 50 feet below the surface.
So literally like hauling the underwater cage up to feed the fish and then dropping them back down again?
Correct.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So you wouldn't even see the farm, wouldn't even know it's there.
Huh.
And that's particularly important during the winter seasons when we have those northeast storms that come through that can do a lot of damage. So the technology is coming along quite quickly to take us out there to those exposed sites. And that's what I see as the U.S. is really getting more involved with. And we're sort of at the cutting edge at UNH because we've been doing aquaculture for 20-some years now. And we have a strong body of engineers, biologists, ecologists that all work together to deal and work out these issues as we move offshore. In fact, back in 2000, we had funding through NOAA to do just that, to explore the open ocean to raise fish. And we still have a 30-acre farm lease offshore, 9 miles, that's exposed to 30-foot waves. And in the past, we've put out different types of experimental cages. We've raised cod, haddock, and halibut, and blue mussels. And we're looking to take another project back offshore this summer.
Mm-hmm. So if I were to say, Michael, right now, let's go. Take me to what UNH is doing in or off New Hampshire's waters right now. What would you be able to show me?
Right now, we have a small floating platform near shore that we use for research, education, and outreach. And it's a very ecosystem-friendly way of growing seafood. Right now, we have a pen, two pens actually, and we have steelhead trout growing inside there. We feed them twice a day. And around the cage, around the perimeter, we have blue mussels and different types of seaweed that grow on these dropper lines. And so essentially, they make up like a biological curtain around the fish, and they filter up the nutrients that the fish put off. Therefore, we have a cleaner footprint on the environment when doing all three species together.
Is that why you use those two things, steelhead trout and the mussels, because they feed off each other, so to speak?
Exactly. Well, they don't feed off each other. We feed the fish food, and then when they excrete the food, both the shellfish and the seaweed can take up the nutrients from that.
I see. So they're not eating each other,
right.
But the waste products are sort of in a closed system. The closed system is probably a more scientific word than I want to use it in this way. But
this would be an open system.
Yeah, okay.
So, but when the fish aren't excreting, then those lower trophic species, the shellfish and the seaweeds, are taking nutrients from the environment. So we find that we can actually pull out more nitrogen than we put in if we have a 3-to-1 ratio kelp and seaweed to trout.
Mm-hmm. So just a few minutes ago, you mentioned that this could happen in any body of water, not just open ocean. Is this happening on any freshwater lakes that you know of in New Hampshire or maybe elsewhere?
Not that I'm aware of in freshwater or even seawater. We're kind of unique in that sense that we are doing all three species together. And the system we are working with is a prototype that was designed and built by UNH engineers. And we just received funding through the National Sea Grant Program to take this system and scale it up and bring it further offshore and then bring fishermen in to train and run the farm so they themselves can learn this new endeavor and perhaps in the future could do this part-time or maybe even full-time if fisheries were to change and go a different direction than what it is right now.
Where is America right now in terms of the progress of its aquaculture compared to other countries?
We are way behind from the sea-based perspective. Todd could talk more about the land-based perspective, but here we have a lot of seascape that there's not a permitting pathway in place that allows us to go offshore. Just a few states can actually do this. We can do it in New Hampshire. You can do it in Maine. You can do it in Washington. You can do it in Hawaii. There's one farm out there. But for most other places, no one's really doing cage culture offshore. Again, it goes back. Some states allow it, and state waters go out to 3 miles here on the eastern seaboard. But there is not a permitting pathway in federal waters, which is up to 12 miles after the state border. And so there's a lot of talk in Washington. They have what's called the Aqua Bill that's been put forth in the House and the Senate to help move aquaculture legislation forward so that we can find a pathway. And if we can create this, then we feel that investment will come forward and start looking at ways to responsibly, environmentally grow seafood offshore in a manner that will be efficient and produce a healthier seafood product for us to eat here locally.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Michael Chambers and Todd Gerdott about aquaculture and aquaponics, the new ways of growing food, or perhaps not so new, but gaining popularity as awareness of climate change and the need for changing food sources becomes more part of public discourse. If you have questions about either of these, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Todd, Michael mentioned that America is kind of behind when it comes to setting up these systems offshore. What about on land?
Well, I think we're pretty much in the same boat, proverbially speaking. The struggle really has been either through permitting on land or offshore. But on land, one of our biggest struggles really is how to figure out a clear pathway to make the food available to a market while also addressing the production of wastes. So location, location, location becomes the big struggle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see a lot of land-based farms right now either being located close to aquatic bodies, so whether rivers, lakes, or oceans, so that they can discharge their wastes, or close to cities where they're then discharging any of their wastes into a municipal system of sorts, all of which costs lots of money, either through permitting or through the actual required treatment costs. So ultimately what we see is not a lot of proliferation of land-based aquaculture because the economics just don't work out at this point. Mm-hmm. If we can find a way to make some money off of the wasted opportunity. You know, we all produce a waste stream of some sort, you and me included, and there are opportunities that animal agriculture has obviously capitalized upon in order to make that a viable solution for us to produce food. So for aquaculture to do the same thing, we need to come up with a solution that represents something that's already tried and true. We're not in the business of recreating the wheel.
Mm-hmm. Consumer demand is going to play a huge part of what the success of both aquaponics aquaculture looks like. Aquaculture, of course, trying to meet the demand for fish that come from here and not from someplace halfway around the world. Chef Jeremy Sewell from Row 34 Restaurant in Portsmouth in Boston, he explained why he thinks steelhead trout farmed via aquaculture tastes better.
It's an open ocean pen, and I think that's really important when it comes to the flavor. It's an environmental thing. It's constantly getting an influx of fresh water as the tides change and the currents flow. They're not sitting in a tank or a concrete bin and just being fed the same filtered water over and over.
And Chef Sewell also spoke about why he used farm fish, even though it's more expensive, in his view, than the other fish that he can get.
This isn't really about cost for us. This is about supporting a method of aquaculture that I think is going to be very important in the future. You know, I don't want to be necessarily in the fish farming business forever. What I want to be is, and what I am in, is the food business and where food comes from and how it's grown, and the people that do it have become more and more important to the planet. And I just think this is just a very small part of, you know, responsible sourcing and supporting a responsible product.
calling it a responsible product. Can you elaborate on that, Michael? Why is it a responsible product to grow it this way or to cultivate it this way?
Well, I think anything that you can serve that is grown locally is much more responsible than shipping something halfway around the world. We also know what goes into that product, the food that goes into it. Our rules here do not allow us to use hormones or antibiotics or any chemicals. So it is a very clean product.
Is it considered organic?
It's not considered organic, and that is still sort of a topic of discussion in the United States as opposed to what is and what isn't. Our fish are fed a diet by BioOregon that is specifically made for trout. It does have fish meal and fish oil in it, but that has the omega-3 fatty acids that you want to have in your fish that makes it healthy for you to eat. You can feed fish other things that may not be as healthy. Soybean is one that can be put into shrimp diets and catfish diets, and they fill a certain profile and are good, but you don't want to eat just soybean. You want to eat other things, a mixture of things that are better for you.
Mm-hmm. He mentioned that it was more expensive. Do you know how much more expensive these are?
I do, and part of that is because the work that we're doing with Row 34 is based upon this prototype system that we're working on. It's small proof of concept, and that's the reason why we're scaling up and moving offshore to look at the economics of it. Mm-hmm. So what we can produce right now is about 7 ton of product. That includes the shellfish, fish, and seaweed. As we move offshore, we're looking closer to 20 ton or 40,000 pounds of product. So that is going to be much more attractive to a fisherman or an aqua farmer that wants to get involved with this, and that'll lower the cost down to the restaurants such as Jeremy.
So that said, how much more expensive is it now?
I don't know what he pays for his wild salmon or farm-raised salmon. Right now, we bring most of it in, and we gut it and bring it to Seaport and Sanders. They fillet it, and then they bring it to most of the restaurants. Mm-hmm. But right now, he's supporting some of the research that we're doing as we work together to learn together. But it also provides a unique vehicle for him to bring out his chefs and his wait staff to go and learn about aquaculture. And as they go back to the restaurant, they can talk about what they just saw, and it gives the customers a better feel of where their food comes from.
Mm-hmm. How might aquaculture impact the community of New Hampshire fishermen and women? Is this competition for them, or is this in some ways a good thing for them?
I don't think it's competition. Even since 2000, we've been incorporating fishermen into the research we do offshore. We work with fishermen right now that are doing offshore mussel culture. We've got a fisherman and his daughter that are involved with seaweed aquaculture. And we see this as an opportunity for them because they have the boats. They're on the water. They're going to their fishing grounds. This can be done on the way to the fishing ground, or as they come back, they can harvest fish. So this is sort of a diversity in what they can do. And we know lobster fishing right now is excellent, and they're making good money. But we see with cod fishing that has gone away for the most part. And so this could be something they could fall back on if the fisheries does change in the future.
And how are you accommodating or planning for that change? I mean, the trend has been the oceans are warming up, and that's going to change which fish thrive in the oceans off New Hampshire's coast. How is aquaculture preparing for this?
That's a really good question. And in fact, close to shore, we see temperatures becoming a little too warm for us. And so that's one of the reasons why we want to move offshore. As you get offshore, you can put deeper nets in, which gives you greater volume to grow product. But also, you can put the fish down into deeper, colder waters, and you get below the thermocline, and the fish will do much better there. And so that's one of the ways we're dealing with climate change, is we have to relocate our farm into cooler waters.
Mm-hmm. We've got an email from Jack who said, maybe I missed the answer, but I think of trout as freshwater fish. And just a follow-up to Jack's email, about there's something about a transition from rainbow trout as hatchlings to steelheads in the ocean. That's sort of a comment I'm seeing on my screen here. But can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. This is one of the unique things about our project, is that we have several hatcheries in New Hampshire that have rainbow trout. They buy the eggs, they hatch them, and they release them into lakes and streams for derby fishing, recreational fishing. But we can take this same rainbow trout at about 100 grams, and we can acclimate it to seawater. In fact, Todd Gerdat was very helpful with us learning some of the closed recirculating systems to take that freshwater fish and slowly bring it up to full salinity. It takes about 2 weeks' time. That better prepares them before they go into the ocean to deal with that full salinity.
Better fish through science, it sounds like.
Correct.
Or at least more useful to humans through science. Todd, you've been quiet. We'll hear more from you after the break about aquaponics. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking with our guests today about new ways to cultivate food. Aquaponics, of course, harvests waste generated by fish to fertilize plants. What do you think about this method? The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can email exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back.
NHPR's Leadership Circle is a community of listeners who place a high value on intelligent and independent radio. I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major Gifts at NHPR. As a Leadership Circle sustaining member, your $100 a month investment helps NHPR create and deliver the award-winning news you trust and the outstanding programs you love. If you've been looking to deepen your commitment to the station that's an essential part of your life and your community, join us at nhpr.org/leadershipcircle.
Coming up tomorrow on The Exchange, grocery stores. Ahead of Thanksgiving, we've got food on the mind here at NHPR. And tomorrow we want to talk about the variety of choices when it comes to grocery shopping. There's upscale, there's organic, there's discount, there's bulk. So many options, which makes consumers like you and me wonder, what do we even want from our grocery stores exactly? And to what extent do we benefit from this abundance of choice? You can send a note about this now. We'd love to read it on the air tomorrow. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Right now, though, we're talking about aquaponics, how it fits into aquaculture. With me in the studio are Michael Chambers, research scientist with the UNH Cooperative Extension and New Hampshire Sea Grant, and Todd Gerdat, UNH Assistant Professor of Agricultural Engineering. And with you, if you've got questions or comments, give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Todd, we'll chat with you a little bit now about aquaponics, because this is something you've been involved in for the past few years at UNH. Describe for us what the aquaponics setup at UNH looks like right now.
So I think to give you a good description, I'll start at the beginning. My background is in water and waste treatment. I apply that to animal agriculture, fish farming specifically, in such a way that we're addressing the production of wastes. I've been in aquaculture for the better part of 14 years, running on land-based fish farms, and have been focusing on waste treatment for quite a while for the purpose of discharging or using it in irrigating crops. As we get to, as my transition comes to New Hampshire, UNH, realizing that the limitation to producing fish on land is costly, we needed to come up with a new model. And so the systems that we've developed here at UNH now really look at ways to capitalize on water treatment requirements, such that the fish have nice clean water, and that the nutrients that we're feeding to the plants are also treated. So one of the big misconceptions about aquaponics is that we are using fish poop to fertilize plants. And in fact, the way we're doing our research right now and the way we conduct our production process is the waste is removed within 15, the solid waste, the poop, is removed within 15 minutes of production. And the remainder is really our liquid stream. So you and I produce a liquid in a solid stream. The solids are removed very quickly from the system. We capitalize on the remaining dissolved nutrients. We treat them using natural biological treatment processes. And that treated water goes back to the fish and the plants at the same time. So we have a scenario where we have food-safe production, we have healthy water for the fish, we have an optimized nutrient solution for the crops. So we end up being able to be much closer to a representative, economically viable solution that meets the demands for a farmer as well as the consumer.
So if I could summarize, you're not necessarily using the solid waste from the fish poop. You're not using that, but you're using the sort of fish urine.
That's probably the closest, best way to approach it.
Is it even called urine when it's from a fish? Or
we're going to say yes.
Okay, let's say yes for the purposes of this program. Okay, so because it sounds like a brilliant system, right? Like, so you're using the fish urine to feed the plants the nutrients it needs, and the plants in turn give back to the fish cleaned out water that they can reuse.
That's exactly right.
This sounds like something if you were to colonize Mars, like you'd bring one of these systems to just have a system that constantly produces life-giving nutrients for humans.
That's exactly right. So, you know, what we're really looking at is a revised model on how we capture and reuse nutrients. And this gives us an opportunity to really maximize productivity under a single roof. We are utilizing more of our input nutrients, I guess you could say. We're increasing our nutrient utilization efficiency. And this approach actually drives up the profit margins for an integrated farm. So this is an integrated farm, much like what Michael is doing. We're just in a much more controlled environment. We have to take control of all of the nutrient production and output in such a way that we can still make a buck at the end of the day. Growing plants in a plastic-wrapped metal-framed structure in the middle of New Hampshire in February turns out to be somewhat expensive since it's cold. But what we've been able to do is really demonstrate that we can produce our crops at the same rate and in some cases faster than a typical hydroponic scenario and produce a representatively more nutrient-rich food product and protein all at the same time under one roof.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of foods are you growing? There's the fish, but also what kind of veggies?
Sure. So from a fish perspective, we use tilapia because they're easy to grow. They grow quickly. They're also the number three most popularly eaten, consumed fish in the world, second only to catfish and salmon. And we're working with rainbow trout and steelhead because we can actually do both of those in these systems, brown trout, and we're getting into striped bass now. From a hydroponic or from a plant perspective, we have been working traditionally with Boston butterhead lettuce because it's delicious. But we also work with strawberries. We've been doing some work with tomatoes. And, you know, really the goal is to evaluate our nutrient solutions, our fertilizers that we're producing, and see how they represent a plant's requirement and then pick the crops that are most effective rather than what a crop researcher would call spray and pray, give the fertilizer to a plant and hope that it grows. We're really taking a big fundamental step backwards and looking at what a plant requires nutritionally. So for every nitrogen it takes, it also needs a phosphorus and a potassium. How are we representatively producing a nutrient solution, a fertilizer that meets the needs of that plant? If we can optimize that, then we can optimize our production processes. And we can ultimately make this economically and environmentally sustainable. It turns out nothing's sustainable if nobody's doing it. And the only way they do it is to make money. So here we are.
Mm-hmm. So what would need to happen for this to become more economically viable?
Well, so I think really this fundamental research, really. So, you know, right now what we have are these production models that are based on what a fish produces from a waste perspective and what's required to discharge it to the environment. What we don't have is what the rest of animal agriculture has. If I want to be a chicken farmer, I walk into my cooperative extension office and I say, I want to grow chickens. The first question they ask is, how many kids do you want to send to college? And I tell them however many kids, they go down the list, they go over on their chart and they say, all right, you need to grow this many chickens, which means you need this size farm. These are your production processes. This is your market. This is how you handle your waste. Take this nice little three-ring notebook over to Farm Credit East and you get yourself a nice farm. Off you go. For aquaculture, we don't have those models. We don't have that production process in place. You ask a system designer how you grow fish on land, you ask six different people, you get six different answers. So for us, we're really working on how to standardize that. And to do that, we follow a model that's already in place. Characterize what the nutrients look like, figure out how that applies to another process, and then put that into play from a conceptual standpoint so we can scale it up in any direction, not just copy-paste.
Listeners, we're having a conversation about aquaponics and aquaculture. For you to join the conversation, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. We got this note from John in Wilmot who said, any thoughts on the use of gray water lagoons for catfish? Back in 2009, UVM was working with Carbon Harvest on a closed-loop system involving the production of fish with algae for use in an industrial generator. So maybe that's a question for you, Michael. Have you heard of this?
No? I have not heard about that.
How about Todd? You seem to know?
I'm familiar with Carbon Harvest. I'm familiar with these waste reuse systems being applied to different processes. Since I'm waste focused to begin with, and I'm most specialized in the aquaculture area.
He mentioned gray water lagoons. What are those?
So I'll furrow my brow because I'm not quite sure, okay. But I'm going to go with probably a waste stream that comes from something other than you and me directly from, let's say, our toilets. So this would be anything other than human waste. Gray water then would represent something that comes from our sinks. And then would require some treatment ahead of time before then it goes in. So that represents a nice place for water for a source of water, but you do have to acknowledge the requirements for the fish. So while I'm not completely familiar with that process, the needs ultimately still rest on what comes out of that fish farm. Production of catfish still produces a waste that requires a treatment before you deal with that ultimate water. Fish don't take up water. Plants do.
Though that does raise interesting questions for me. I don't know if you have the answer to this, but is there a branch of aquaculture or aquaponics that relies on human-generated waste that could sort of mitigate the effects of human-generated waste? Todd, you're shaking your head. This doesn't seem to be a thing.
No, at this point, no. I seem to be okay with that.
you don't want food that's grown on human waste.
That's right. You know, well, so I'm actually a proponent of using the waste that comes from our municipal treatment systems for land-based aquaculture or for land-based agriculture, because our waste that comes from us that's produced from our municipal treatment systems represents something that's appropriate for use in a soil-based system. In order to take the waste that you and I produce and use it in aquaculture, there is no benefit for that for fish. The fish don't need that. Now, perhaps there's a pathway to using that for a hydroponic crop, but ultimately the fish need clean water without nutrients in it to start. Plants are the ones that need the nutrients dissolved in there. So from a fish perspective, I say no. From a plant perspective, let's do some research.
We got a note from Lauren who wrote us to say, I've always been interested in aquaponics, but have not had the opportunity to participate. My question is, what about growing very popular vegetables here in New Hampshire, such as avocados?
Ooh, that's a long-term crop right there. So, you know, so we have a couple of issues that go into that. Number one is any long-term crop requires lots of protection. Lots of protection means lots of infrastructure, and lots of infrastructure means lots of money. Boy, I love avocados, I'm not going to lie to you. But I think the question of what is sustainable really rests on this concept of whether or not local is truly sustainable all the time. And when it comes to growing a tree or a long-term crop in a greenhouse, we have a lot of money invested in that crop. So there's a lot of risk that's associated with that. And in agriculture, we don't have a very high return on investment. So anything that we grow, what we're really trying to in a greenhouse, in a protected environment, especially in the Northeast, needs to have a profit margin that is going to make it viable for us. And so, you know, without being an avocado agriculture specialist, my understanding is that it takes quite a while before that tree produces a fruit. So it's possible, but really what we're looking at are more stock turnovers. So we look at quick turnovers, we look at cash crops. So that's where the tomatoes come in, or cucumbers or strawberries. So something that's really important to the New Hampshire is fresh produce in the winter. That's why lettuce is a huge sell in the Northeast in general. And that's why farms like Leaf Farms and Little Leaf Farms down in Massachusetts, Leaf Farms up in Loudoun, both are doing very well because they're producing a fresh local crop that they try not to ship beyond 100 miles from where they produce. We're looking at going beyond that. So crops that are super interesting to New Hampshire is strawberries. We have a very strong strawberry market here, but we only get them in the month of June. We're doing research now where we're capable of producing strawberries year-round. We've got strawberries in our greenhouses right now, and we're going to have strawberry fields in February. and we will be able to produce those year-round. And that's going to be a big market for the local economy because people really want to get something that doesn't come from California. We harvest closer to ripeness, and we get a better-tasting fruit, and it's all money that stays here in the economy locally.
What about, because Lauren mentioned the idea of participating. She thought, hadn't had a chance to participate yet. I mean, is there a way that, you know, if you have a couple acres, if you have a barn, can you get aquaponic equipment and sort of have your own fish and then grow your own vegetables in that way? Is there a system ready to let this happen for people who just want to do it on their own?
So the short and long answers are yes.
Okay.
If you go on YouTube, obviously you can pull up a million different ideas and how aquaponics is conducted by a million different people. Roughly 2.5, I think, right now are the number of hits that you'll get. But they're all based off of a model that is either not conceptually addressing food safety, or the water treatment requirements for the fish and the plants collectively.
So there's a fair bit of science involved for anybody who wants to try this at home.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, what happens is you'll see more DIY, do-it-yourself, failed results where you can do it on a small scale for a short period of time before ultimately you end up with an accumulation of waste products. Hmm. So unless we can appropriately deal with how to put that together in a scenario that anyone can scale at any size, we're always going to have these small-scale systems that see a higher failure rate. So for us, what we're trying to do is kind of apply the science to the practice. I work with a number of students, a number of student groups, both in engineering as well as agriculture, so that we can break out these fundamental processes into what we call unit processes. And then we're actually working on creating a group that will build a YouTube channel so that we will explain each of these different processes so that you can then turn around and build it at your house on a small or a large scale.
I had a question about public perception. In your experience, how do people generally respond when you say, hey, yeah, this head of Boston lettuce, this was grown with fish pee? Maybe that's not the way
I would never say that.
You would never market it that way. But I mean, that's
yeah, absolutely.
But at the same time, you also maybe want to educate people about the value of hydroponic or aquaponics.
I think that's absolutely right. What we're looking at really doing is turning this around and helping educate the consumer in such a way that we are producing food crops in a similarly clean way that any other animal agriculture does. There's not as much guidance from the USDA as to how to do this from a food safe standpoint. In fact, there isn't specific guidance on how to do that, and that's what is really driving our funding at this point. We're funded by the USDA to look at how to grow these in such a way that we can be food safe. So we use wasted nutrients, not pee or poop.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Ken emailed with a question that is sort of related. Ken writes, I heard some farmers in New Hampshire are indignant about doing any farming that is not from the ground. What culture change needs to happen to get aquaponics and hydroponics more widely used? The plants are more healthy and safe, says Ken. Why is there so much resistance?
Ken, I love your question.
Do you know Ken?
I don't know Ken, but that's a great one. So to start, we see, nationally speaking, we see a decline in the number of farmers. And while we see an overall average age of a farmer increasing, so that represents a pretty big challenge to food production in the United States. But when we look in the Northeast, we actually see the only sector in agriculture that's growing are the number of new farmers. And 75% of those new farmers are under the age of 45. So we are seeing that cultural change right now. The struggle right now is really understanding what it is that a plant needs. So plants don't need soil. And this is the response I get from that is not pretty. But plants need nutrients dissolved in water, so whether that water's in soil or in a tank, it doesn't matter.
Well, Todd Gerdat, thank you very much for speaking with us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Todd Gerdat is UNH Assistant Professor of Agricultural Engineering, and Michael Chambers, thank you as well for being here. Really appreciate your insights.
Pleasure to be here.
Michael Chambers is research scientist with the UNH Cooperative Extension and New Hampshire Sea Grant. Coming up on the program, recently host of NPR's 1A, Joshua Johnson, visited New Hampshire to host a few programs. I sat down with him for a chat about how he does his job in front of a live audience at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. We'll hear that conversation after a break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoi. Joshua Johnson, host of NPR's 1A, has been hosting focused, incisive conversations about all manner of subjects since early 2017. Recently, he paid a visit to New Hampshire to host a few hours of the program from here. And while he was here, I had an opportunity to speak with him about how he does his job. We took the stage last month at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, and we started our conversation with the question submitted by someone in the audience.
We've got a question here from Karen in Rye, who says, I listen to your show often, and you never seem nervous. What, if anything, makes you nervous when you're interviewing somebody?
I'm always nervous.
Really? Are you nervous right now?
Well, our producers who work on 1A put a lot of work into these shows, and there are some days when I go and I'm like, oh my God, please don't let me screw this up. Somebody put a ton of work into this show. So there are plenty of days where I'm like, oh God, today's show is going to be so good if I just don't screw it up. Please, please, please. And then there are other days where I'm just tired, or I'm frustrated, or I'm cranky, and I haven't been, you know, fed and walked that day. And so I'm just not on my game in here, but I have a show to do, so I just have to suck it up and do it. I don't get nervous like, oh my God, there's 400 people here, what am I gonna say? Because I'm used to this. Like, my other degree is in theater, so I'm not afraid of being in front of an audience. I know several of you are like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Whenever I say that, this wave of realization goes over the audience. So this doesn't make me nervous. I think it's more that space between my brain and my mouth. That's what makes me nervous. Because there are a lot of people listening, and there are a lot of people who are like looking to NPR as this bastion of sanity and hope in crazy times. And so I know that a lot of you are putting a ton of pressure on us to be what you need, as opposed to just being human beings who sometimes have an off day. And I know that, and I know that, and I get that, and I accept that. So some days it's just like, okay, what I'm dealing with has to wait for 2 hours, and then I can go fall apart at noon, but it's 10:06, so let me suck it up and do the show.
Well, interviewing is really hard, and you know, when you're interviewing on a live radio show, you don't have the opportunity to say, wait, let me redo that. You know, you're not sitting behind a computer, and you don't have a chance to edit. What lessons have you learned over the years that have made you become a better interviewer?
Stop trying to interview people and just converse.
Just chat.
Just talk.
Yeah.
Just talk. One of Kai Ryssdal's best pieces of advice is just talk, man. Just talk. Like, we have a list of questions. Our producers put a lot of work into booking these guests and pre-interviewing them and knowing what they could talk about and where their expertise was. And I had a good, strong list of questions. But at the end of the day, like, I have to be in the moment of a conversation. So there were plenty of times tonight when I totally diverted from the order of the questions because there was just something that felt more organic or that flowed more naturally or that occurred to me. And I think if you're just looking down at the sheet and trying to do it like a deposition, it's harder, because you're worried about getting this piece of information about this question that I asked, as opposed to, let me just be here with you. Let me just try to connect with you. And let me let you know that what you're saying is valid to me and that it's important. To me, that is easier. It makes you a little more vulnerable. It's a little more naked, because you don't have like the status of being the interviewer, and you are just my guest, so I can't kind of give you the 60 minutes treatment, but I think it makes for better conversation, it's more insightful, and it ultimately makes for a better program. It prevents me from, you know, it prevents me from buying into my own hype, quite frankly, if I am the interviewer, as opposed to just like someone who has welcomed you into our space and let's talk, and oh, by the way, let's just let the whole nation hear us while we talk.
Yeah, but there's that, but there's also the idea that as an interviewer, it's not about you, it's about your guest, right? Where as in a normal chat, there would be more of an even playing field. So is there a way to have that normal chat while also not making it about you?
Well, yeah, I mean,
which you're successful at. I mean, you don't make it about you.
I try not to. I mean, if there's something personal that's germane to the conversation, I'll share that. I try never to make it about me, but it's usually not that hard. I mean, we book pretty good guests. I think if I have to make a conversation more about me, the guest sucks. I mean, but we book interesting people with stories to tell. It's like when you have a conversation and you ask somebody something and they keep giving you these monosyllabic answers. And then you have to be like, so I went down to Kroger the other day and I bought a, like when you have to drive it, that's when you know something's wrong. But that so rarely happens. So rarely.
Nancy from Bedford wanted to know, how do you prepare for your shows? You're always so knowledgeable.
The point of the show is not really for me to be prepared. It's that conversation. Like, that's the point. And it's not even a conversation that's all my questions. It's my questions plus your questions. So I don't have to know everything about the topic. I think about doing this work sometimes. I used to think about it much more. Like, I'm cramming for a test that I want to get like a 75 on. Like, I want to know enough to ask you the right questions, but not so much that I volunteer all the answers. Like, I don't want to be the know-it-all. My job is to be the ask-it-all. And I need to know enough so that I can kind of call BS as necessary, but not so much that I feel like I have to kind of match your expertise. That's just too much. Mm-hmm.
Amy from Derry wants to know, how do you maintain your composure and sense of humor in the face of a guest who is, this is Amy's word, oppositional?
Oppositional?
Oppositional.
Rudeness does not fly on our show. And if you are rude to me or a guest, I will spank you live. Because we don't do that. Like, we don't invite you into our home as a guest and then hang out with the rest of our guests, and then you're rude to someone else I invited, hit the bricks. You don't do that in my house.
Have you ever had someone do that, where during the break you've just said, sorry, you
No. We've never had to eject anybody, but we have had a few occasions where we've dealt with a guest and we had to be like, hey, no, we don't do that here. Like, cool it. We will give both of you time to talk. And it rarely happens, partly because we know the guests we're pre-interviewing, and they know who else is going to be on, and if they have drama with one another, they'll often volunteer like, yeah, I've got an issue with her, and we don't get on really well. And that's good for us to know, because then we can decide, well, maybe we have you on in the A segment and you on in the B segment, so both of you can be heard, and it doesn't become this spitting match. That's legitimate. But if you are upset about an issue that affects your family or your health or your livelihood or your community, you might have a very good reason to be oppositional. Like, your anger, your frustration, your pain, your fear, your derision, your cynicism might be part of the story. And if I try to ask you to calm down, I might denature what it is that makes you who you are in this narrative. So part of my work is figuring out why somebody is oppositional and giving them the room to just be what they are in that moment. We did a show this year when we visited Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor about police brutality and police corruption in Baltimore. And one of our guests was this former Baltimore police officer who now works in law enforcement reform. I started and I asked him, so can you give us a sense of like one of the experiences you had with Baltimore PD that kind of stands out to you in terms of this issue? And he immediately leaped on his soapbox. And his soapbox was like 10 feet high and he had water balloons to throw from up there. We need to do something about the prison industrial complex and law enforcement and policing of this country was set up to be an extension of Jim Crow and it's only about imprisoning black people. And if people in this country would understand, I'm like, hey, I just wanted a story. Please, slow down. There'll be room for that. I finally pulled him back on track. Get back around to him, ask him another question, right back on the soapbox again, just going at it, something fierce. And finally, we get to a point in the program, I think it was about halfway through the conversation, I'm like, God, I don't know what I'm going to do with this guy. But he starts to give an answer, and as he gave the answer, I almost missed it. I don't know how I caught this, but I heard in his anger, his voice quivered that much. Like, you know when someone is really angry and they have this moment where their emotions turn? That. And it arrested me. And all of a sudden, my whole mood changed. I was like, oh, God. And I felt crappy for having judged this man on the inside. And when he calmed down, I said to him, I can't remember what his name was, but I said to him, you know, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot here, but when I hear you tell the stories about what you saw and what you're seeing, you sound traumatized to me. Do you still carry trauma from your work as a police officer? and he said, I put people behind bars who are better people than I am. Hmm. And I said, that's it. That was what was wrong. Part of our job as journalists is to tell your story and not to judge your story before we tell it. And I think there's this thing about public radio that makes people think they have to be very calm and very erudite and talk in 14-letter words before we will take them seriously. But our job is also to reflect the nation back to itself, including sitting with you in moments that are really, really painful and really uncomfortable and very socially inappropriate and highly controversial, because we're built for that. NPR is built for that. And if I hadn't come up in public media, if I had come up in a different form of media, I might have been a little more afraid to sit with him in that. But we've got the time and the space and, quite frankly, the temperament to do that kind of work. So show up angry, show up depressed, show up fearful, show up combative, show up oppositional. Just show up and be honest and tell your story.
Mm-hmm. So how did the producers on the show go about selecting which voices to use from your voicemail system or the emails? This is a question from Kirk in Ware. How does this editorial decision get made?
In terms of the topics or the voicemails?
Voicemails or email listener questions and comments.
We try to find the ones, particularly that where people share their lived experiences. You'll often hear us on the show say, share what you know about. So we tend to look for people who have firsthand experience with a topic or with an issue. So when we craft the call-outs for the show, we'll do it, we'll kind of think as a group about what kinds of stories we want from folks. Sometimes we just do want a gut check. You know, some days we just want to know, where is your head at with this issue, and what are your questions and what are you thinking about? But in general, if we go for a voicemail or an email, we're looking for somebody who's got something personal to say about it that's illuminating and not just, I got a bone to pick with these people. Like, we know you got a bone to pick. Pick it later. We're trying to help give you some guidance so you know where to point the bone that you're picking. But typically, personal experience will win out all the time. Mm.
When did you know public radio was the career for you?
I was like I didn't know when it was the career for me. I think I knew when local TV news was not the career for me.
You worked in TV.
I worked in local TV, and I have nothing against television. I do some television work now, but I always loved broadcasting from when I was like 5, and I've never really wanted to do anything else. Like, this is all I'm good for, folks. I'm really sorry. besides this, I am utterly useless. I think public radio became my choice. And I had been listening to public radio since I was about 13. My mother turned me on to it. Josh, oh my goodness, I've just discovered this new thing. It's called National Public Radio. Have you heard of it? And she discovered it in 93, and National Public Radio had come out in 1971, so clearly she discovered it 22 years in. But she was my route in. And I think after I had moved back home, I'm from South Florida, and I'd moved back and worked for one of the stations in my hometown as an assignment editor and hated that job. God, I hated that job. And then the opportunity to help WLRN start up its local newsroom in a partnership with the Miami Herald, when that came up, I was like, please, pick me. Got hired, got the job, and I was like, this is it. Now, I don't know what the future holds. I mean, who knows what the rest of my career path looks like, but public media met with my values, and it spared me from having to hearken my ear to the police scanner all day and listen for something bad to happen to someone so we could call it news. That to me is necessary. It doesn't mean it's not news. It just, and there's a place for it. I just felt like there was a higher calling in life. And if we're gonna do that, let's do some of the other stuff where no one has to die for me to be able to punch in and punch out for the day. Mm. Where no one has to get shot, where no one has to lose their home, or like, mix it up. Like, read a city council agenda, for God's sake. Learn how to read the school board agenda. Learn how to go through, like, quarterly earnings reports or the community calendar. Like, what are people happy about and excited about? I just couldn't get that in local TV news. It was like breaking news, investigative reports, weather, and hard news, and there was no room for life.
Was there someone in public radio, a journalist or a host, that you looked up to and sought to emulate?
I don't know if I sought to emulate it. I was always kind of fascinated by the voice of Robert Siegel on All Things Considered. But I mean, it was him. There was always, you know, Carl Kassel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Kassel.
And I always kind of like hearkened to the radio when I heard him. But I don't know that there was any like one person that I wanted to be in public radio. The three people who I always wanted, I think my most of my influences were from television, for better or worse. And I think the three people I wanted to be, I always wanted to be kind of an amalgam of Bernard Shaw from CNN, Arsenio Hall, and Oprah. That was kind of my... That's my Venn diagram. Because Bernard Shaw was just unimpeachable. Like, he was the news. And he wasn't perfect, but when he spoke, you were like, okay, tell me what I need to know. And he just had that kind of reputation where you knew he did the legwork. Like, he had all the receipts, and he was going to do it right. And if something was wrong, he'd tell you. Like, I wanted to be that trustworthy where I could just walk in and speak and not have people like, I don't know where you're coming from. And I always kind of admired that. Also, as just an African-American man in news, who I had many of those role models growing up, him, Ed Bradley, Lester Holt, you know, Leon Harris, there were anchors where I grew up, Dwight Lauderdale and Ted White and others. So that caught my eye. I always loved Arsenio because he was about kind of the cutting edge of things. You know, you went to Johnny Carson when you arrived. You went on Arsenio when you were taking off. And I wanted to know where the people were who were kind of on their way. I always wanted to be kind of at the cutting edge. And Oprah was just Oprah. She could go anywhere, do anything, had ubiquity. And anything she could imagine, they could make happen. And I wanted to be able to have that kind of creative freedom and ubiquity where I could just kind of go and say, this is an idea that I think is good.
Make it so.
And we could just make it happen. So that was always kind of more of my interest in terms of the kind of work I wanted to do. I never grew up wanting to be famous, like being recognized. Even now, it's a little bit of a strange experience. But I always wanted to be able to have that kind of creative freedom, of that kind of credibility, that kind of innovation, and that kind of ubiquity, the freedom to just kind of do whatever.
Well, we're glad you're able to do whatever on 1A, on NHPR, and at stations across the country. Joshua Johnson, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
And that's it for today, but our earlier conversation about aquaculture and aquaponics continues online on Facebook or at nhpr.org. That was Joshua Johnson, by the way, host of 1A, speaking with me before a live audience last month at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.